were nurtured and encouraged by our mothers. We both think of ourselves as outsiders, even when we are in the White House. We're both stubborn, a trait that allows us to take risks but can tip into arrogance. We both act as if we don't care what other people think about us, but we do. Yet these similarities form only a small part of a broader picture, a reality in which I was a junior partner who worked hard to understand what my boss wanted to say and do in the world. Barack Obama came to office with a different worldview from those of his predecessors and the type of largely white male people who serve in elevated national security positions, one that encompasses the complexities of U.S. foreign policy. He was born in Hawaii, a former U.S. colony that hosts America's Pacific Fleet, nurtures a diverse citizenry, and serves as a bridge between the Americanized Pacific and East Asia. His grandfather served in Europe during World War II, and his great uncle helped liberate the concentration camp at Buchenwald. He lived in Indonesia as a child, just years after a U.S.-supported coup initiated bloodletting that killed hundreds of thousands of people, the kind of event that barely registers in the United States, but shapes the psyche of a foreign country. His mother worked to help women make a living from weaving clothes or baskets beyond the borders of the developed world. His father came of age during Kenya's liberation from British imperialism and was educated at some of America's finest universities. When he returned to Nairobi, he ended up marginalized as a member of the minority Luo tribe, a technocrat whose Western ideas clashed with a culture of corruption and patronage. Ultimately broken, unemployed, and alcoholic, he died in a car crash. And, of course, Obama became centered in his own identity as an African American, joining a continuum of those who had suffered oppression but managed to achieve change through nonviolent mobilization. So just about every aspect of American power and its role in people's lives since World War II lurks somewhere in Obama's background. Our capacity to keep the peace abroad and to disrupt it. Our capacity to transform individual lives through both our generosity and our callousness. The allure of our democratic values and our imperfection in realizing them. Yet the strangeness of this background to many Americans left plenty of space for people to misunderstand or misrepresent how it impacted his view of American foreign policy. To some on the right, it was a sign that he must nurture a reflexive opposition to American power. He must be a Kenyan anti-colonialist, a fellow traveler of the likes of Fidel Castro and Yasser Arafat. But the experience of Obama's own family showed that liberation without mature institutions is its own form of oppression, as corruption and tribalism can overwhelm the individual. Yes, Obama believes in the liberation of peoples, but he is at his core an institutionalist, someone who believes progress is more sustainable if it is husbanded by laws, institutions, and, if need be, force. To some on the left, there was a mirror image, an expectation that Obama would be hostile to America's national security state. Yes, he harbored a deeper concern about overreach, how our policies affect people in places like Indonesia. The casual manner in which, from Vietnam to Iraq, we failed to consider the consequences of our actions, the dangers of unchecked executive power. But Obama believed in a competent, stabilizing force, the necessity of taking military action against certain terrorist networks, the benefits of globalization and lifting people out of poverty, the indispensability of the United States to international order. He wanted to redirect the ocean liner of American foreign policy, not sink it. And to many in government, the president's worldview doesn't really matter. Every agency has its own interests, which don't change with the presidency. The military wants more freedom of action. The State Department wants to sustain existing relationships and arrangements. The intelligence community wants more capabilities. Everyone wants more. More money, more people, more support from the White House. Usually, a president presses his agenda through the leadership of these institutions. Yet Obama took office without an established set of relationships with the type of people who take those jobs, because he had been in Washington for a total of only 4 years. Most of the people who filled the top positions at Obama's State Department or Pentagon were people he had never actually met. In Obama's first year, I was in a smaller circle of White House aides who knew Obama, had internalized his worldview, and had no personal or institutional interest beyond helping him articulate his foreign policy. Because he was spending most of his time trying to rescue the economy, he turned to speeches as a vehicle to reorient American foreign policy, to communicate a new direction not just to the American people and audiences abroad, but to his own government. And because of how much he cared about words and trusted me, I often got an uncurtained window into his thinking, one that made me a bridge between his speeches and his actions. This became clear to me with two speeches in May. For weeks, Obama had made a series of decisions about national security issues related to the rule of law. His plan for closing Gitmo had been complicated by congressional opposition. He decided to release the Bush administration memos justifying torture, but not to prosecute those responsible. He chose not to release photos showing U.S. troops abusing prisoners abroad. But the ad hoc nature of these decisions grated on him, as he felt there was no context to these announcements we were making, no guiding vision. So there was talk of him giving a big speech laying out his approach to all of these issues. His personal assistant, Katie Johnson, called me up to the Oval Office with a simple, "POTUS wants to see you." When I got there, he had a legal pad in front of him with what looked like a lengthy outline on it. "Here's what I want to say," he said. "Do you want me to get anyone else?" I asked. "Why don't I just give this to you? You can fill in the others." With that, he proceeded to pace slowly around the Oval Office for nearly an hour, pausing every so often over the pad on his desk, dictating his outline. Within it, he had embedded a series of policy decisions and how he wanted them framed, about how to categorize detainees at Gitmo, about how to balance transparency and secrecy in government. When he was finished, he told me to scrub it with the rest of the staff and get him a draft in a few days. And so I had the awkward responsibility, as essentially a mid-level staffer, of calling a meeting the following day with the senior White House staff so that I could tell them what the president wanted to do. As I was working on this speech, it became clear to me how agencies form their own antibodies against a president's desire to move in a particular direction. A practice of having the intelligence community review speech drafts had been put in place after George W. Bush overhyped Saddam Hussein's efforts to acquire nuclear material in his 2003 State of the Union address. Now, Obama wanted to assert that tactics like waterboarding amounted to torture. The intelligence community struck that formulation, preferring the more antiseptic, enhanced interrogation techniques. Obama wanted to call Gitmo a danger to American national security. The intelligence community wanted to strike that. Obama wanted to say that the 240 Muslim detainees in Gitmo had spent years in a legal black hole, a relatively non-controversial statement, since no one at Gitmo had been convicted of a crime. The intelligence community wanted to delete that sentence as well, offering instead this justification. "The detainees at Guantanamo have more legal representation and have been afforded more process than any enemy combatants in the history of the world." Sitting in my windowless office and reading those comments, I felt the gap between working on a campaign and working in the White House. The person I was working for was President of the United States, and a figure uniquely revered by people around the world. But his views did not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. government. On a late Saturday morning after the speech, I was back in the Oval Office to get Obama's initial thoughts on another speech that he was going to give 2 weeks later in Cairo. The fact that he was giving it at all was rooted in a relatively obscure line in the first major campaign speech I'd drafted for him almost 2 years ago. Sifting through a list of proposals submitted by different advisors, I'd found the idea of addressing the Muslim world during my first 100 days in office. In August 2007, it had seemed a distant enough idea, and one that captured Obama's potential to change America's image abroad. Over time, it took on a life of its own among Muslim populations, who had high expectations for an American president named Barack Hussein Obama with Muslim relatives. As we took office, it was referred to inside the White House as simply the Muslim speech. After the inauguration, there was some debate about whether the speech should be given at all. There was enough to do without having Obama fly somewhere to speak to a global faith community that most Americans viewed with suspicion. But the anticipation around the speech, from Muslims and the media, raised the cost of walking away from the idea, and we ended up presenting Obama with two choices for where he could deliver the speech. Jakarta, the place where he had lived as a boy, which offered a venue for him to talk about a more tolerant brand of Islam, or Cairo, which was the center of a region that had been the source of so much extremism and instability in recent decades. Jakarta was the safer choice, far from the wars, conflicts, and autocrats of the Middle East. And that's precisely why Obama chose Cairo. "Let's be honest," he told a group of us. "The problems are in the Arab world, not Indonesia." In the weeks leading up to our Oval Office session, I cast a wide net for what to include, reaching out to academics, religious leaders, and prominent Muslim Americans. Within the government, even as bureaucracies can be rigid, there are deep reservoirs of talent, and the people who spent their days thinking about how to engage Muslims around the world seemed relieved at the chance to have their ideas heard at the White House. Much of the advice focused on what the United States had done wrong. The global war on terrorism had made many Muslims think that all we cared about was terrorism, and that we viewed them all as potential terrorists. As one Muslim colleague said to me, the phrase radical Islam is heard by many Muslims as a characterization of Islam itself and not of a faction within it. Meanwhile, the polling that had been done showed that what most Muslims actually cared about was poverty, corruption, and unemployment. If you asked them what they wanted to work with America on, the answers were education and entrepreneurship, science and technology. If you asked them what U.S. policy was focused on, they said oil, Israel, and weakening the Muslim world. "We should begin," Obama said on that Saturday, "with the history of colonialism." He asked me to come alone to these sessions, but this time I brought McDonough along. There was going to be a lot that Obama wanted to say, I knew, that might be unpopular with other advisors. I wanted a witness so I wouldn't be fighting these battles by myself. "We need to name the sources of tension." He was walking slowly in a circle around where I was sitting on the couch, scribbling down what he was saying on my notepad. "Then go to the Cold War, and how there was a tendency to see the Middle East as peripheral to the world's concerns. And that has to change." He wanted to describe a new framework for how we could cooperate with the Muslim world. "The West," he said, "has to re-educate itself about Islam and the contributions that it has made to the world. And Islam has to recognize the contributions that the West has made to articulate certain principles that are universal." He ticked through Islam's contributions to art, science, and mathematics when we were a backwater, including himself in what would have been, at the time, Europe. "Then, we need to talk about the contributions that America has made. The goal," he said, "could be shorthanded as, we have to know each other better." He talked about how religious absolutism ultimately fails as a means of governing, just as imperialism does. He stopped walking when he landed on some language that he wanted to use in the speech. "Any world order that elevates one group of people over another will fail." He sat down in the chair facing us. "Then I want to talk about how I benefited from experience in both worlds. Some of the language about how you've had Muslims in your family and learned to appreciate Islam in Indonesia?" I asked. "Some of that," he said. "I'd say I appreciate the differences, but I've also learned that there are things that all people aspire to. More opportunity for their children, family, faith. These things we share." He summed up what would be the wind-up portion of the speech, and then a transition to more difficult issues. "We can't ignore the basis for tensions. Those are genuine. We won't ignore them or brush them under the rug. We need to face them squarely. Sometimes Obama has a way of talking that feels as though he's trying out ideas, testing whether they sound right spoken out loud, wanting people to argue with him. Other times he has a clear sense of what he wants to say, formulated in his mind while he sat in meetings, watched ESPN, played cards, worked out, or lay awake at night. This felt like one of those moments. He ticked through a list of issues he wanted to address. The need to wipe out terrorist networks without compromising our values. Iraq and our plans to draw down our troops. Israel and Palestine. The pursuit of a nuclear agreement with Iran. Then we went into the social issues. Democracy, opportunity, gender equality. Each of these questions, he said, deals with how we interact with Islamic countries and how modernity interacts with Islam. Occasionally, my eyes would drift to the family photos behind the Oval Office desk, and beyond that, out the windows, to the playground set he'd installed for his daughters. In the rose garden, his mother-in-law sat on a small bench talking to a visiting friend. He said we had to find a way to reach Muslims who didn't think it was such a great thing to have McDonald's down the street and American pop culture on their television. All people, he said, want to maintain their identity in the modern world. We should acknowledge that not everything we see is positive. There's a mindless violence, a crude sexuality, a lack of reverence for life, a glorification of materialism. That said, he wanted to make several statements of belief in human progress, that countries succeed when they are tolerant of different religious beliefs, that governments that give voice to their people and respect the rule of law are more stable and satisfying, and that countries where women are empowered are more successful. When I was a kid in Indonesia, he said, I remember seeing girls swimming outside all the time. No one covered their hair. That was before the Saudis started building madrasas. This was a theme he'd come back to again and again. He told a story about how his mother once worked in Pakistan. She was riding on an elevator. Her hair was uncovered and her ankles were showing. Yet even though she was older, this guy in the elevator with her couldn't stand to be in that type of space with a woman who was uncovered. By the time the door opened, he was sweating. He paused for effect. When men are that repressed, they do some crazy shit. When he was done, we talked through a few issues. One was democracy. I pointed out that the challenge wasn't just the sensitivity of addressing the issue in a repressive country. It was the fact that if there was ever a real election in Egypt, the Islamist party, the Muslim Brotherhood, would probably win. America tended to express support for the type of democratic activists who would get only a small percentage of the vote, and it made us less credible. Obama paused on this, then offered a formulation. The United States should welcome the legitimacy of all political movements, even those we disagree with, but we will also judge any political movement by whether they choose to act and govern in a way that is consistent with democratic principles. Little did we know how that position would be tested at the height of the Arab Spring. I spent several days working on the speech, often hiding out in my second, unused office in the EEOB where nobody could find me, sanding down harder-edged points, filling out the policy sections with inputs from the rest of the government. I worked with a devout Muslim on the White House staff, Rashad Hussein, to sprinkle in references from the Quran. To personalize it as much as I could, I ended up lifting almost verbatim a line from the culmination of Dreams from My Father, describing Obama's thoughts as he sought a connection with his absent father in Kenya, which spoke to a search for something universal in people, no matter where they came from or what they believed. It's a belief that pulsed in the cradle of civilization and that still beats in the hearts of billions. It's a faith in other people, and it's what brought me here today. Given the high profile of the speech, we also tried to nudge forward different policies. A few weeks before the speech, Obama had written a secret letter to the Supreme Leader of Iran, indicating an openness to dialogue on the nuclear program. In response, we'd received a secret letter back, a long and obstinate recitation of the perceived crimes of the United States particularly the U.S. role in a coup that overthrew the Iranian government in the 1950s and installed the repressive Shah. The letter indicated that relations between nations had to be approached with courage, rectitude, and resolve. Since letters weren't going to set a new tone, in the speech we tried to set a new tone for dialogue with Iran by acknowledging the past, thinking it necessary to name the difficult history in order to move beyond it. In the middle of the Cold War, Obama would say, the United States played a role in the overthrow of a democratically elected Iranian government. Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage-taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well known. Rather than remain trapped in the past, I have made it clear to Iran's leaders and people that my country is prepared to move forward. To send a message to those watching carefully in Iran, we inserted the Supreme Leader's own words, turning them back at him. It will be hard to overcome decades of mistrust, but we will proceed with courage, rectitude, and resolve. The most heavily scrutinized section was about Israel and the Palestinians, an issue that also drew on the varied aspects of Obama's background. On the one hand, he had deep roots in the Chicago Jewish community, which has been historically close to Israel. On the other hand, he had empathy for the Palestinian predicament. During a campaign debate prep, he snapped at me when I suggested going easy on Israeli settlements. If we can't criticize settlements, then we might as well go home. In Israel, Benjamin Bibi Netanyahu had just been elected prime minister, and his government, along with its supporters in Washington, were expressing concerns that Obama would use the speech to lay out a peace plan. White House advisors like Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel and Tom Donilon, who was Deputy National Security Advisor, shared those concerns. The speech should not be seen as about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, they said, because that would validate the view that all the problems in the Middle East were rooted in Israel's occupation of Palestinian land. The caricature of Rahm is that he swore all the time, and he did. But a lot of the time, he seemed to do it to live up to his caricature, the Secretary of Fucking Agriculture, rather than to put people down. More than being profane, he was constantly in motion. The first time he called me with edits to a speech, he was swimming. He was avowedly pro-Israel and pro-peace, and he kept a careful eye on the politics of Israel. He argued that it was going to be hard, if not impossible, for a center-left government in the United States to make peace with a center-right government in Israel. But he felt that trying was important. When he got tired of hearing me argue that Obama had to show empathy to the Palestinians, he started calling me Hamas. "Hamas over here," he'd say, "is going to make it impossible for my kid to have his fucking bar mitzvah in Israel." Rather than put forward a peace plan, Obama accepted a recommendation to call for a halt to Israeli settlements that were encroaching further into the land necessary for a Palestinian state. Rahm and Axe were occasionally smeared as self-hating Jews for any pressure we put on Israel, but instead of pushing back on the smear, we usually responded by reciting all the ways in which we were supporting Israel. In Washington, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, and other organizations friendly to Netanyahu had established themselves as the adjudicators of what was pro-Israel, and they had zero tolerance for any pressure on the Israeli government and enormous influence with Congress. Most Americans, of course, also felt a natural affinity for Israel. As we got closer to the date of the speech, the lobbying grew more intense. I was asked to sit down with Lee Rosenberg, one of the leaders of AIPAC, who had been a fundraiser for Obama's campaign. Rosie, as he was called, wanted to make sure we weren't breaking new ground in our support for the Palestinians, or indicating that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict was the root of all problems in the Middle East. He then implored me to call on the Muslim world to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. This was a formal position that the United States had not yet taken, as it would be a signal that millions of Palestinian refugees will not have the right to return to Israel as part of a peace agreement. I sat there and took his request on board, assuring him that we were breaking no new ground in our support for the Palestinians. The Israelis were by far the stronger party in the conflict, but we were acting as if it was the reverse. One final decision was whether Obama should travel to Israel after going to Cairo. Given the concern about not wanting the speech to be seen solely through the prism of the Arab-Israeli conflict, we decided not to go. Ironically, we would be criticized for years by Netanyahu's supporters for that decision, even though it was responsive to their concerns. Indeed, this established a pattern, a post facto criticism of Obama for not being sufficiently pro-Israel, which ignored the fact that he wasn't doing anything tangible for the Palestinians, and which absolved Israel's own government for its failure to take any meaningful steps toward peace. By the time we took off for Saudi Arabia, the stop that came before Cairo, Obama had given me a speech draft that was covered in handwritten edits, in the margins, on the backs of pages, on torn-off pages from a legal pad. He was frustrated by the flood of edits that watered down points he wanted to make. "I'm not going to fly all the way to Cairo to give this speech and then whiff," he told me tersely. Axe worried that the speech didn't have a headline and was too theoretical for an American audience. While my colleagues slept all around me on the overnight flight, I stayed up, the glow from my laptop illuminating the small handwriting on Obama's marked-up pages in front of me. The anxiety I felt at working on a speech that would be carefully parsed around the world was eclipsed by a confidence that Obama was making the speech better, and that his heavy editing could serve as a justification to ignore the stream of notes that continued to flood my inbox. When we landed, we went to one of the many compounds owned by Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah. It was laid out like an Arizona subdivision, complete with golf carts that transported you to identical housing units amid the rolling desert. When I opened the door to my unit, I found a large suitcase. Inside were jewels. In my sleep-deprived state, I thought that maybe this gift represented some kind of bribe to the person writing the Cairo speech, until I heard from others who had received the same suitcase. You're not allowed to keep these gifts unless you are willing to reimburse their cost, which ran into the tens of thousands of dollars. I took a nap while Obama met with the king. Later that night, I joined him as he recapped the day. He was irritated. The Saudis had let him down, refusing to take Gitmo detainees and holding back on a peace gesture with Israel. He passed me some more edits to the speech, and I stayed up late working through them in a staff office that was in a large, ornate room with heavy curtains and throne-like chairs. Obama came in shortly before midnight to talk through a few sections with me and Dennis McDonough. "There's a lot of discomfort with using the word occupation," I said, referring to the edits to the Israel section that continued to come through. "What else are we supposed to call it?" he asked. We ended up affirming our unbreakable bond with Israel, calling Holocaust denial baseless, ignorant, and hateful, and declaring that threatening Israel with destruction or repeating vile stereotypes about Jews is deeply wrong. We tried to balance this with language that spoke to the daily humiliations, large and small, that come with occupation, and saying the situation for the Palestinian people is intolerable. The next morning, we flew into Cairo, descending over a sprawl of low-rise housing and empty roads. On the way in from the airport, Egyptian security forces stood with their backs to the motorcade, uniformed men only a few paces from each other for miles. There were no people on the street in one of the most crowded cities in the world. Thousands of uniformed personnel had been ordered to face away from the cars, looking out into the distance, searching for anyone who might pose a threat. The speech was being given at Cairo University, and I waited with Obama in a nondescript hold room as the audience was seated. "This speech is going to raise expectations," he said. "I think we were pretty careful in saying that a speech isn't going to solve all these problems," I replied. "Yes." He paused. "You know, Bush's second inaugural is a great speech, but you can't just promise to end tyranny in the world." He let the thought hang in the air. He'd just met with Mubarak, a tyrant who had ruled Egypt for decades. "The language is great," he added. "It's probably Bush's best speech. I think we landed in a good place, I said. I hope nobody throws a shoe at me, he said. I felt imprisoned in my chair, which was on a balcony along the wall. But as soon as Obama opened with Assalamu alaikum, the audience erupted in cheers, and I felt the tension recede. We had selected a crowd that mixed secular activists, intellectuals, political leaders, clerics, women's rights activists, and members of the Muslim Brotherhood. All of the factions who would fight it out in the streets of Cairo a few years later were represented in one room, cheering for the parts of the speech they liked. The clerics applauding Obama's defense of a woman's right to wear a hijab in the United States. Activists yelling, "We love you," when he spoke about democracy. Women cheering when he talked about a society needing to unleash the potential of its girls. After the speech was over, we flew by helicopter to the pyramids. "I think that went okay," Obama told me. For an hour, we got a private tour of the ancient monuments that dot the desert on the outskirts of Cairo's sprawl, crawling through small chambers, squinting at ancient words chiseled into the walls, looking at the sarcophagi of pharaohs. As we posed for pictures, we had a remarkable sense of privacy. There were no other people in sight. Mubarak had set a broad security perimeter, a gesture that spoke to his power. One authoritarian leader inviting his American patron to tour the tombs of his long-dead authoritarian predecessors, structures with far more permanence than words. In the years to come, I'd get asked again and again how I felt about the Cairo speech, especially as Islam and the West, and Islam and modernity, continued to be in tension. Touring the pyramids that day, though, I knew that it wasn't the kind of speech that could be measured against the state of the world at any one particular moment. It expressed what Obama believed and where he wanted to go, the world that should be. In writing the speech, and over the course of the trip, we'd seen the forces aligned against that outcome. The contradictions of American foreign policy, the corruption of Saudi Arabia, the repression in Egypt, the extremist forces lurking just out of sight, the intractability of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Years later, after Obama left office, I ran into a Palestinian-born woman whom I knew casually. She said she'd never forgotten the Cairo speech, which she connected to the initial protests of the Arab Spring. I said that that was assigning too much responsibility to a speech. "It wasn't the speech," she said. "It was him. The young people saw him, a black man as president of America, someone who looked like them. And they thought, why not me?" Chapter 6. Obama's War. When Obama took office, we had been at war in Afghanistan for 7 years, longer than our engagement in the Revolution, the Civil War, World War I, or World War II. And yet, because he had supported the war in Afghanistan and called for 2 additional combat brigades during the campaign, the media started calling Afghanistan Obama's war shortly after he became president. The phrase always bothered me. It struck me as a prime example of how Washington looked at something as morally consequential as a war and turned it into a political drama. During his first year in office, there was an inexorable demand for Obama to pour more troops into Afghanistan. The stage had been set during the transition. The commander in Afghanistan, General David McKiernan, had requested more than 10,000 additional troops in order to blunt the growing momentum of the Taliban insurgency, a request that the Bush administration left for Obama to fulfill. Obama approved McKiernan's request in February, effectively fulfilling his campaign commitment. He had also ordered an initial review of our policy, resulting in the March 27th announcement, which emphasized that Afghanistan and Pakistan needed to be approached with a common strategy so that we could root out the terrorist sanctuaries on the Pakistani side of the border. But that review deferred a decision about whether to embrace a counterinsurgency, COIN strategy, one that would require many more U.S. troops for a much longer time. Within the government, and the group of people who think, write, and talk about foreign policy, The debate about what to do in Afghanistan was becoming a proxy for a debate about what had gone wrong in Iraq. To Obama, the failure of the Iraq war was the decision to invade in the first place. To some supporters of the war, the results generated by a counterinsurgency strategy that involved putting more U.S. troops into the fight to secure the Iraqi population demonstrated that the problem in Iraq had been the strategy for fighting the war, not the war itself. But while dissatisfaction with the war in Iraq allowed Obama to become president, during his first year in office, our Afghanistan policy would be shaped in large part by people who embraced the indispensability of COIN. Bob Gates was exactly the right mix of competent, diligent, calculating, and occasionally hypocritical to thrive in Washington for decades. Throughout the 1980s and 90s, he held a series of high-level positions at the CIA and on the NSC. When I worked with him on the Iraq Study Group, he was comfortably installed as president of Texas A&M University, home to the George H.W. Bush Presidential Library, which had been significantly funded by wealthy Saudis and Kuwaitis grateful for America's help during the Gulf War. In his trips to Washington, Gates arrived nearly 30 minutes early for each meeting, a habit that sent a message about his discipline. He would draw a cup of coffee into a styrofoam cup, sit at an empty table, and flip through documents as he waited. As Secretary of Defense for the last 2 years of the Bush administration, Gates succeeded as an effective manager of the massive Pentagon apparatus. He also forged a close partnership with the commander in Iraq, General David Petraeus, who became a rock star within the Republican Party because of his willingness to be the public face of the war at a time when George W. Bush was an increasingly unpopular figure. Obama got along well with Gates, whose calm demeanor and clinical manner of speaking earned him the nickname Yoda. Obama felt he needed continuity at the Pentagon at a time when he was going to remove 150,000 American troops from Iraq and spend much of his early presidency averting a Great Depression. He also kept Petraeus, who had been promoted to head of Central Command, CENTCOM, the sprawling military region that included the Middle East and South Asia. Petraeus was a smart man who chose his words carefully. In 2009, he was at the height of his influence over the thinking that guided the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was so popular in some circles that he was mentioned as a potential Republican presidential candidate, though he volunteered to me more than once on the sidelines of Situation Room meetings that he had no interest in politics. In demeanor, he came across more as an academic than a politician, with carefully parted brown hair and a habit of delivering his advice in studious paragraphs that created word clouds around the PowerPoint slides in front of him. Hillary Clinton proved to be an effective manager of the State Department, combining tenacious support for her foreign service officers with an alert political antenna. She made a point of demonstrating her preparedness for meetings, showing up with thick binders of briefing materials that she would page through intermittently during discussions. Her curiosity led her in eclectic directions. On our first foreign trip together, she started a lengthy discussion with me about the need for the United States to pursue a more nuanced foreign policy toward the Arctic region, describing how thawing ice caps were initiating a competition for resources and affecting the movement of ships. On the wars, she often sided with the military. Throughout 2009, she rarely took a position in an internal discussion about Iraq or Afghanistan that differed from Gates's. Within the State Department, Richard Holbrooke had been named her special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, SRAP, a position she created just for him. Holbrooke was a towering figure in the Democratic Party's foreign policy establishment. He had forged a heroic narrative around his diplomatic prowess over 3 decades, from his time as a young Foreign Service officer in Vietnam to his negotiation of the Dayton Accords, which ended the war in Bosnia. While SRAP wasn't the level of appointment he sought, he harbored a lifelong ambition to be Secretary of State, he turned the office into an empire within the State Department, hiring a mix of accomplished academics and talented young acolytes who served as a deeply loyal cohort and kind of mini think tank. Having reached the pinnacle of his power in the 1990s, a high water mark for American influence in the world, Holbrooke retained a persistent belief in the ability of the United States to shape events abroad, even in a region as war-torn, complex, and foreign as Afghanistan and Pakistan. He also reveled in the theater of being a leading diplomat. After one meeting, he guided me out of the State Department by the arm and, as if on cue, the mayor of Karachi stepped out of a car, and the three of us huddled conspiratorially, Holbrooke reciting statistics about the city's water supply as if it held the key to success in the AFPAC region. The only senior official who consistently opposed sending more troops to Afghanistan was Joe Biden. As vice president, Biden floated in a unique space, somewhere above everyone else and below Obama, but without an agency like state or defense to give him an independent power base in the government. At 66, he was two decades older than Obama, and also embraced a more old-fashioned brand of politics. He'd walk through the hallways of the West Wing, stopping to talk to people, gripping your forearm and holding on to it while he spoke. Obama liked that Biden had an instinct for this brand of politics, and came to love him with the almost protective sense of devotion to an older family member. In the Situation Room, Biden could be something of an unguided missile. Whereas Gates was stealthy in his bureaucratic maneuvering, Biden would go on long discourses about why it was foolish to think we could do anything more than kill terrorists in Afghanistan, and he solicited military advice outside the chain of command that prepared requests for more troops that would work their way up to Gates and, ultimately, Obama. He would pepper his comments with anecdotes from his long career in the Senate, repeatedly declaring that experience had taught him that all foreign policy is an extension of personal relationships. He learned the names of all the grandsons of the Iraqi Kurdish leader Massoud Barzani. He detested Afghanistan's president, Hamid Karzai, and thought the U.S. military was jamming Obama. Amid this outsized cast of characters, the man who did the most to frame Obama's Afghanistan decision in 2009 was General Stanley McChrystal, whom Gates installed as the war's top general that May. The 54-year-old McChrystal had a mythical reputation in the military. He helped to build America's special operations capability in Iraq and Afghanistan, the elite troops who kicked down doors, captured or killed terrorists, and mapped insurgencies like doctors tracing the spread of cancer within a patient's body. He was surrounded by a tight cohort of loyal officers, including General Michael Flynn, who were more comfortable in the distant headquarters of a war zone than in Washington. If Petraeus was the polished intellectual architect of a strategy that sought to secure Iraqi and Afghan neighborhoods, McChrystal was the fit field soldier who unwound by drinking Bud Light Lime and had spent years sharpening the tip of the spear. On September 21st, 2009, I woke up to a Washington Post story by Bob Woodward that began, "The top U.S. and NATO commander in Afghanistan warns in an urgent confidential assessment of the war that he needs more forces within the next year and bluntly states that without them, the 8-year conflict will likely result in failure," according to a copy of the 66-page document obtained by the Washington Post. A flurry of other leaks revealed that McChrystal was seeking 40,000 to 80,000 additional U.S. troops. All of us in the White House, including Obama, read about these things in the newspaper before the recommendations reached his desk. The brazen nature of the leaks left me feeling a bit overwhelmed. They were boxing Obama into sending troops into Afghanistan and setting him up to take the blame for any bad outcomes that followed if he didn't, even though those outcomes were likely to happen anyway. Over the past several weeks, the pressure on Obama had already been building. The troops he'd sent into Afghanistan hadn't made much difference, and the August elections led to credible allegations of massive voter fraud by the incumbent president, Hamid Karzai. Influential Republicans like John McCain were already calling for more resources to replicate the success of the surge in Iraq. A cult of personality was emerging around McChrystal, who had received a series of glowing profiles after his appointment. He was the savior who was going to salvage Afghanistan, just as Petraeus had done in Iraq. The stage was set for a Washington drama. Would the young anti-war president back or buck the advice of these wise and experienced advisors? A week after the McChrystal report was leaked to the Washington Post, I was formally promoted to Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications and Speechwriting, an absurdly long title that I would hold until the end of the Obama presidency. Up to that point, the leadership of the NSC had been split among four people. At the top of the pyramid was Jim Jones, a four-star general and former commandant of the Marine Corps, who looked like a tall, square-jawed, handsome actor playing the role of a four-star general and former commandant of the Marine Corps. Jones never quite took to the role of staffer. He tended to float above the NSC like a monarch, serving as an effective envoy with foreign governments and offering advice on issues that interested him. He had a strange habit of giving this advice to Obama while looking at someone else in the room, which sometimes put me in the awkward position of holding eye contact with him while he spoke to the president. He had no problem letting others around him brief Obama, which allowed the Deputy National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, to carve out an influential role. Donilon was the kind of guy widely known inside Washington and nearly anonymous outside it. As a young man, he'd been a sharp-elbowed political operative working for Jimmy Carter in the White House. While his brother Mike never left the role of political consigliere for Joe Biden, Tom worked hard to make a turn from politics to foreign policy. He spent the Clinton years in State Department roles and the early 2000s credentialing himself through the types of establishment organizations that function as a farm system for future national security officials. The Aspen Strategy Group, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Atlantic Council. His closeness to Rahm, together with Jones's hands-off style, allowed him to take control of the levers of national security decision-making. The coordination of different agencies that prepare options and recommendations that go up to the president. Then there was a bottleneck. After the election, both Mark Lippert and Dennis McDonough wanted to come to the White House to be, essentially, Obama's guy on the NSC. Lippert had served in Iraq until the summer of 2008, and during that time, Dennis had taken his place as Obama's lead national security staffer. The two of them were friends, former Hill staffers in their 30s. They shared an office meant for one person, and each kept changes of clothes there to account for endless hours. They were both capable of performing the role of multipurpose aide and gatekeeper, being the decision-maker on issues related to Obama's schedule, controlling the paper flow, working with the White House on communications strategy, helping staff the government, making sure Obama's personal priorities were addressed. But they both couldn't keep doing the same job. Ultimately, Lippert would be the one to leave. I liked Lippert, and always thought he missed the days of being Obama's Senate aide, without all the politics of working in the White House. He had loved serving in the military, and that summer he arranged to have himself redeployed overseas. As this played out, Dennis told me that he was going to take the job of NSC Chief of Staff, and he wanted to know if I would take his position as Deputy National Security Advisor for Strategic Communications. I'd have a standing invitation to Deputies Committee and Cabinet-level Principals Committee meetings, he said, and NSC meetings with Obama. I would be in charge of communications on national security, preparing Obama for his press conferences and interviews, and Robert Gibbs for his press briefings, running a staff of about 10 people at the NSC, and coordinating the spokespeople for state, defense, and other agencies. I would also be in charge of the sprawling ways that the United States reaches foreign publics, from exchange programs to information operations. I said I needed some time to think it over. I couldn't imagine saying no, but something made me uneasy. I liked the idea of having more of a voice on policy and more stature in the White House. I didn't like dealing with the press that much, but was assured, falsely, that that could be delegated. My one demand was to keep writing the major national security speeches. I was also able to hire another national security speechwriter, Terry Zuplat, who proved to be a rock of intelligence and stability for the next 7 years. The source of my unease didn't become clear to me until I delayed telling Anne about this new opportunity as we were driving back to D.C. from a weekend in New York, shortly before our wedding. I mentioned that Dennis had floated the prospect of this job. She went quiet and looked out at the road. "So that's a Deputy National Security Advisor position?" she asked. "Yes," I said. Her response was neither negative nor enthusiastic. "We're going to be in Washington for a while, aren't we?" "Not necessarily," I said. But in that moment, I knew what had been churning inside me since Dennis first broached the job. I'd made a choice, back in 2007, to go work for Obama to see if I could help get him elected. Since then, I had never really thought about what my job would be other than writing speeches. Now, I was being offered the kind of position that carries more responsibility than writing another man's words, that puts you in charge of other people, that begins to define you to the wider world, and yes, that keeps you in Washington for a while. "You know we will," Anne said. "But it's an unbelievable opportunity." I looked out at the passing darkness of southern New Jersey, the exits getting farther apart as we approached Delaware. I'd made the drive to and from New York dozens of times since I'd moved down to D.C. as a 24-year-old who figured I'd be there for a few years and do some interesting things before moving back to fulfill my true calling, writing for a magazine or churning out books. My best friends, who I almost never had any time to speak to anymore, all lived there. My brother had just recently welcomed his second son. Anne and I were about to get married, and this promotion was going to ensure that I wasn't going to move to New York or anywhere else for the foreseeable future. I wasn't going to go to happy hours after work, or watch live music, or keep in touch with old friends, or go to movies and read books as they came out, or see a lot of my parents before they got older, or see my nephews grow up. Instead, I was going to be a Deputy National Security Advisor. Here is how I was officially elevated to this position. I talked to Gibbs, who described how he liked to be prepared for his briefing while checking his fantasy football team on the computer in front of him, concluding with, "This will be fun." Then Axe came down to my office and closed the door. He worried aloud about whether I had the stomach for the day-to-day grind of dealing with the press. "I can see you doing well with the thoughtful people like David Ignatius," he said, citing the Washington Post columnist, managing in his own unique way to praise and put me down at the same time. But that was it. There were, as far as I could tell, no other candidates, and no one considered that I might say no. Obama told me in passing, "I want you in the room more," something he'd tell me more and more over the years until I was in the room all the time. A few weeks before the change became official, Anne and I were married. We held the ceremony in Los Angeles. Orange County was out of the question for a New Yorker. New York was too expensive and out of the question for a Californian. Washington didn't feel like home to either of us. It felt like a place where we worked. So we chose a venue in a Los Angeles park, behind the striking Art Deco Public Library, Southern California enough for Anne and her family, urban enough for me and mine. It was a spectacular spot, the skyscrapers surrounding us, the weather just right. To me, it also suggested that we were people, at that moment, who weren't really from anywhere. We didn't live at home, but we also weren't ready to go back home, wherever that was. The biggest contingent at our wedding were Obama people, the late 20s and early 30s set, people who'd bonded on the campaign and become something of a family. For one night, we set aside the stress of our jobs and had a party. The DJ played a hip-hop playlist. A conga line danced on the walls of a fountain. I sang George Michael's Freedom 90 into the DJ's microphone standing on a wall. It felt like the period on a stretch of time when we all hadn't quite been promoted to positions of higher responsibility, before people took over departments of government, joined the cabinet, had kids, got divorced, succeeded in, or failed out of, government, or went off to make money. At the end of the night, Samantha Power was carried dramatically out of the wedding party by her husband. Dennis McDonough and his wife flew back to Washington on a red-eye. Favreau stayed up most of the night to draft a speech that Obama would give to a joint session of Congress, urging that they pass health care reform. We took only a couple of days off after getting married. Instead, Anne and I delayed our honeymoon by over a year because I had to get back to Washington to prepare for the United Nations General Assembly and the looming Afghan review. After I moved into my new job, the U.S. government installed a communications system in our small two-bedroom apartment. Anne called it the command center. It took up a chunk of our living room and occasionally made strange noises during the night as a system of fans turned on to cool the devices. Sometimes it was so loud that it woke us up. When I complained about this to people at work, I learned that these noises were not uncommon. I was just the only person with one of these installations who lived in a small apartment, a place where it could not be stored in a more distant room, out of earshot. I still lived in a young person's home. Chapter 7. War and a Peace Prize. The Afghan review was one of those dramas that Washington loves while it is happening and then moves on from as soon as it's over. The meetings usually ran 2 to 3 hours. Obama sat at the head of table, flanked by officials in descending rank order, with others joining by secure video conference, including McChrystal and Carl Eikenberry, our ambassador in Afghanistan. In the early meetings, Obama said he didn't even want to discuss the resource request before we established what was achievable. But it was always the unspoken presence in the room. Obama wanted to show his government how he went about making decisions, so we needed to understand what was happening in Afghanistan and Pakistan, define our interests, test what resources were necessary, weigh those needs against all of our other priorities at home and around the world, and then make a decision. Obama wasn't against sending in more troops, but he wanted to make sure we didn't define their mission in overly broad terms. He would sit there taking his own notes while different principals talked. Then he would offer his own summation at the end of the meeting. In painstaking detail, he worked to establish a few baselines. Al-Qaeda and the Taliban were allied but distinct. The former a terrorist group trying to attack the United States, the latter a domestic political actor inside Afghanistan. The Taliban could not be defeated so long as it had political support in Afghanistan and a safe haven in Pakistan. Pakistan would not abandon its support for groups like the Taliban so long as their primary concern was having proxies against neighboring India. It was clear he wanted to focus on defeating Al-Qaeda, not on remaking Afghanistan. That, in turn, would mean fewer troops for a shorter period of time. For me, it was a time of transition into a new job where I'd be involved in the closed-door meetings and be responsible for shaping the public view of what was taking place in them. I felt a small thrill at being with such well-known people sitting in a row of chairs along the back bench of the Situation Room, taking notes. But I rarely spoke, unsure of when to weigh in, deferential to more experienced people who largely saw my role as putting out generic statements that did more to obfuscate our deliberations than illuminate them. Today, the President and his national security team met to discuss the situation in Afghanistan. Meanwhile, people steadily leaked information that all pointed toward Obama's sending in 40,000 troops, and it felt as though I had little ability to control anything other than the inevitable speech that Obama would give when the 3-month review was over. Early in the process, we made an effort to steer the public debate. Gibbs had me invite a couple of New York Times reporters to the White House to speak to John Brennan, who was Obama's top counterterrorism advisor. This is the kind of thing you do when you want to signal that you're communicating something important. Arrange for an interview with someone who rarely grants them. Tell the reporters that you want to offer a sense of our thinking. Brennan was a career CIA guy who appeared to do nothing but work. He once had a hip replacement and came to the office the next day. His experience in the Middle East made him skeptical that the United States could shape events inside the countries there, even as he was adamant about the need to take out terrorist networks. He spoke sparingly, but with a precision and gravitas that made you stop and listen closely. He used to complain when people used the word fulsome as a synonym for robust, because it actually is a synonym for noxious. He looked